says I made for you. Think about it.
There are many stories.
This is Marina Abramović, and you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM Accra Creative Community Radio.
Beautiful.
Have a good day.
You're listening to Quintron's Weather Warlock. Live stream of an analog drone synthesizer played by the weather, made by the New Orleans-based artist Quintron. You can listen to the Quintron Weather Warlock take the changes in weather at Wave Farm in Greene County and hear it anytime, 24 hours a day, at wavefarm.org/listen, or go to any WGXC.org webpage and click on the listen button to hear Quintron's Weather Warlock, turning the changes in precipitation and sunlight and wind and temperature into sound.
From Survival comes an economical do-it-yourself fallout shelter.
Civil defense approved and easy to assemble. Takes just...
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, it is Monday, the third day of July, of the 23rd year of the second Christian millennium. Actually, I guess it's the third Christian millennium. Two of them are already done. I thought I hit the pause button on that. Anyways, I'm still here, and you're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. The show's Good Night Norman on WGXC.org, WGXC 90.7 FM in beautiful Columbia and Greene counties. I think there was a promo a minute ago that was talking about an app that played the sound of the weather in the background. You can hear the sound of the weather as I speak because, for one thing, my windows are open because it's toasty up here, and I'm not a fan of air conditioning. But it's cool outside because it's raining water from the sky instead of other things that come from the sky for whatever reasons we apparently deem necessary in order to maintain this lifestyle of freedom and the pursuit of happiness. Oh, I guess the word is liberty, not freedom. I don't know. Anyways, it's 3rd of July, and I'm going to read some stories, mostly very short, starting with the Book of Imaginary Beings by Jorge Luis Borges, the Argentinian scribbler, late. I'm going to read from the Norman Thomas DiGiovanni translations because I'm not a fan of the Andrew Hurley translations that Penguin released in concert in, I guess, in deference to his for his wife. She had a beef with Giovanni. Anyways, I don't know what that's all about. All I know is that this first piece is called The Three-Legged Ass. Pliny reports that Zoroaster, the founder of the religion still professed by the Parsis of Bombay, wrote 2 million lines of poetry. The Arab historian Al-Tabari states that the holy man's complete works, given eternal life by devoted calligraphers, required 12,000 cowhides. We know that Alexander of Macedonia ordered that the manuscripts in Persepolis be burned. But the fundamental Zoroastrian texts were saved through the remarkable memory of certain priests. Since the 9th century, these texts have been complemented by an encyclopedic work called The Bulletish contains the following passage. Regarding the three-legged ass, they say that it stands amid the wide-formed ocean, and that its feet are three, its eyes six, its mouths nine, its ears two, and its horn one. Its body is white, its food is spiritual, and it is wholly righteous. And two of its six eyes are in the position of eyes, two on the top of the head, and two in the position of the hump. With the sharpness of those six eyes, it overcomes and destroys. Of the nine mouths, three are in the head, three in the hump, and three in the inner part of the flanks, and each mouth is about the size of a cottage. Each one of its 3 feet, when it is placed on the ground, is as much a flock of 1,000 sheep may lie in when they repose together, and each pastern is so great in its circuit that 1,000 men with 1,000 horses may pass inside. As for the beast's 2 ears, it is Mazandaran, which they will encompass. Its one horn is like unto gold and hollow, and 1,000 branch horns have grown upon it, some befitting a camel, some befitting a horse, some befitting an ox, some befitting an ass, both great and small. With that horn it shall vanquish, and it shall put to rout all the vile corruption brought about by the efforts of noxious creatures. Such ends that quote. And finally, we know that amber is the dung of the three-legged ass. In Mazdaic mythology, this beneficent monster is one of the helpers of Ahura Mazda, also known as Ormuzd, the principle of life, light, and truth. Continuing with the truth, this passage is called the Bahamut. The fame of the Bahamut reached as far as the deserts of Arabia, where men changed and magnified its image. At first, a hippopotamus or an elephant, at last it was transformed into a fish that floats in a bottomless sea. Above the fish, the men of Arabia pictured a bull, and above the bull, a mountain made of ruby, and above the mountain, an angel, and above the angel, six infernos, and above the infernos, the earth, and above the earth, seven heavens. Here is the story of this creature in Lane's translation. The earth was, it is said, originally unstable, and therefore God created an angel of immense size and of the utmost strength, and ordered him to go beneath it and place it on his shoulders. But there was no support for his feet, so God created a rock of ruby, and he ordered this rock to stand under the feet of the angel. But there was no support for the rock. Wherefore God created a huge bull with 4,000 eyes and the same number of ears, noses, mouths, tongues, and feet. And God, whose name be exalted, ordered this bull to go beneath the rock, and he bore it on his back and his horns. But there was no support for the bull. Therefore God, whose name be exalted, created an enormous fish that no one could look upon on account of its vast size and the flashing of its eyes and their greatness. And God, whose name be exalted, commanded the fish to be a support to the feet of the bull. The name of this fish is Bahamut, or Behemoth. He placed as its support water, and under the water, darkness, and the knowledge of mankind fails as to what is under the darkness. Another opinion is that the earth is upon water, the water upon the rock on the back of the bull on a bed of sand, the sand on the fish upon a still, suffocating wind, the wind on a veil of darkness, the darkness on a mist, and what is beneath the mist is unknown. So immense and resplendent is the Bahamut that human eyes cannot bear to look upon it. All the seas of the earth, placed in one of the nostrils of its nose, would be no more than a grain of mustard in the midst of the desert. In night 496 of the Burton's version of the Thousand and One Nights, we read that Isa, known to us as Jesus, was allowed to see the Bahamut, and when this gift was bestowed upon him, he fell down in a swoon, and did not awake from the swoon that had come upon him for 3 days. Later we read in addition that beneath the huge fish there is a sea, and beneath the sea, quote, a vast abyss of air, and under the air fire, and under the fire a mighty serpent. Fiction of the rock standing upon the bull, and the bull upon Bahamut, and Bahamut upon something else, could well be an illustration of that cosmological proof of the existence of God which argues that every cause requires a prior cause, so that at last, if one is not to go on to infinity, one comes to the necessity of a first cause. Continuing in the cause of causality, this passage is called The Baldanders. The Baldanders, whose name, singular in the German, might be translated, quote, suddenly different, unquote, or suddenly other, unquote, was suggested to the Nuremberg shoemaker Hans Sachs by that passage in the Odyssey in which Menelaus is attempting to subdue the Egyptian god Proteus, who transforms himself into a lion, a serpent, a panther, an immense wild boar, a tree, and finally, water. Hans Sachs died in 1576. Some 90 years later, the Baldanders reappeared in the sixth book of Grimmelshausen's fantasy picaresque novel, Simplicius Simplicissimus. In a forest, the hero comes upon a stone statue that he takes for the idol from some old Germanic temple. He touches the statue, and the statue tells him that it is Baldanders, and that it can take the shape of a man, an oak tree, a sow, a sausage, a meadow full of clover, dung, a flower, a flowering branch, a mulberry tree, a silk tapestry, and many other things and beings, and then once more, a man. It attempts to teach Simplicissimus the art of, quote, speaking with things which by their nature are mute, such as chairs and benches, pots and kettles, unquote. It also turns itself into a secretary and writes these words from St. John's Revelations, quote, I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the ending, end quote, which are the key to the coded document in which the instructions for that art are written. Baldanders adds that its coat of arms, like the Turks, though with more justice, is the inconstant moon. Baldanders is a successive monster, a monster in time. The title page of the first edition of Grimmelshausen's novel bears an engraving that portrays a being with the head of a satyr, the torso of a man, the outspread wings of a bird, and the tail of a fish. With one goat's foot and one vulture's claw, it stands atop a mound of masks, which might be the individuals of the species. On its belt, there hangs a sword. Its hands hold an open book, with the figures of a crown, a ship, a chalice, a tower, a baby, a pair of dice, a fool's cap with bells, and a cannon. Now you know everything about the concept of first cause. I'm going to read Banshees. No one seems ever to have seen one. They are less a shape than a wailing that lends horror to the Knights of Ireland, and according to Sir Walter Scott's letters on demonology and witchcraft, the mountain regions of Scotland. Heard outside one's window, they herald the death of some member of the family. It is the peculiar privilege of certain lineages of pure Celtic blood, with no trace of Latin, Saxon, or Norse, to hear them. They're also heard in Wales and in Brittany. They belong to the race of elves. Their wailing is known as keening. So because it's raining and we're talking about causes, I'm going to read The Bird That Makes the Rain. In addition to the dragon, Chinese farmers might call upon the bird known as the Shang Yang to bring them rain. It had but a single leg. In ancient times, children would hop on one leg, wrinkle their foreheads, and shout, "It'll soon rain, for Shang Yang is frolicking in the yard." It was said that the bird drank water from the rivers and dropped it upon the land. In ancient times, a wise man domesticated this fowl, and he would walk about with it upon his sleeve. Historians say that one day the Shang Yang, flapping its wings and hopping on its one leg, passed before the throne of Prince Qi, who, alarmed, sent one of his ministers to the court of Lu to consult with Confucius about this event. Confucius predicted that the Shang Yang would cause floods in the principality and in the lands nearby, and he advised that dikes and canals be built. The prince followed Confucius' advice, and thereby avoided great disasters. Two passages on demons. The first, the demons of Judaism. Lying between the world of flesh and the world of the spirit, Judaic superstition has it there is an orb inhabited by angels and demons. Its population exceeds all arithmetical possibility. Through the centuries, Egypt, Babylonia, and Persia have helped shape this fantastic world. Perhaps under the influence of Christianity, Trachtenberg suggests, demonology, or the science of demons, came to be less important than angelology, or the science of angels. We might, however, mention the name Kete Meriri, the lord of midday and hot summers. A group of children on their way to school met up with him. All but two of them died. During the 13th century, Judaic demonology was infiltrated by Latin, French, and German interlopers who began to commingle with those listed in the Talmud. Hence, the next passage, Swedenborg's demons. The demons of Emanuel Swedenborg, 1688 to 1772, are not a species apart. They belong to the species of mankind. They are individuals who, after death, choose hell. They are not happy in that region of marshes, deserts, jungles, fire-ravaged villages, brothels, and dark lairs, but they would be unhappier still in heaven. Sometimes a ray of celestial light penetrates to where they are. The demons experience it as a fiery burning and a foul stench. They consider themselves beautiful, but many of them have faces like beasts, or mere pieces of flesh, or have no faces at all. They live in mutual hatred and armed violence. If they come together, they do so in order to destroy one another or someone else. God forbids men and angels to draw a map of hell, but we know that its general shape is that of a demon. The most sordid and horrible hells are in the West. I didn't write it. This is called the Lamia. According to the Latin and Greek classics, the Lamia lived in Africa. From the waist up, their bodies took the form of a beautiful woman. Below, that of a serpent. Some reports have called them sorceresses, others malign monsters. They lacked the faculty of speech, but their whistling was melodious. They would lure travelers to themselves in the desert and then devour them. Their remote origins were divine. They sprang from one of Zeus's many amours. In that part of the anatomy of melancholy that treats of the passion of love. Robert Burton tells the story of a Lamia that assumed human form and seduced the young philosopher, quote, taking him home to her house in the suburbs of Corinth. Or maybe it's Corinth. I think when I was in Greece, a long time ago, it was called Corinthos. Anyways, she being fair and lovely would live and die with him. That was fair and lovely to behold. The young man tarried with her a while to his great content, and at last married her, to whose wedding came Apollonius, who by some probable conjectures found her out to be a serpent, a Lamia. When she saw herself discovered, she wept and desired Apollonius to be silent, but he would not be moved, and thereupon plate, house, and all that was in it vanished in an instant. All right, everybody wants to know about nymphs, and so here we are. Paracelsus would have it that they live only in water, but the ancients divided the nymphs into water nymphs and land nymphs. Some of these latter beings were wood nymphs, the presiding deities of woods and groves. The hamadryads lived invisible inside trees, and died when the trees died. Other types of nymphs were believed to be immortal, or to live for thousands of years. Those who lived in the sea were called oceanids, or nereids. Those who lived in rivers, naiads. Their exact number is not known, but Hesiod ventured the figure 3,000. They were grave and lovely maidens. Seeing them might bring on madness, or, if they were naked, death. A line from Propertius avows that fact. The ancients brought the nymphs offerings of honey, oil, and milk. They were minor deities. No temples were built to them. Next passage is titled One-Eyed Beings. In Spanish, the English word monocle is rendered monoculo. Before this word was used as the name of an eyeglass, it was applied to those men or creatures that had but a single eye. Thus, in a sonnet composed in the early 17th century, Góngora spoke of what we might translate as the monocled suitor of Galatea. He was referring, of course, to Polyphemus, and in his fabula he dedicated to that monster lines that exaggerate but do not compare to those praised by Quintilian in the third book of the Aeneid, which in turn exaggerate but fall short of those lines in the Odyssey, Book 9. This literary decline corresponds to a decline in poetic faith. Virgil attempts to impress the reader with his Polyphemus, though he hardly believes in him, while Góngora believes only in the word. Verbal artifice, verbal creature. The race of Cyclops was not the only one-eyed race. Pliny mentions also the Arimaspi. Not far from the spot from which the north wind arises, the Arimaspi are said to exist, a nation remarkable for having but one eye, and that placed in the middle of the forehead. This race is said to carry on a perpetual warfare with the griffins, a kind of monster with wings, as they are commonly represented, for the gold which they dig out of the mines, and which these wild beasts retain and keep watch over with a singular degree of cupidity. while the Aramaspi are equally desirous to get possession of it. 500 years earlier, the first encyclopedist, Herodotus of Halicarnassus, wrote the following. Then again, towards the north of Europe, there's evidently a quantity of gold by far larger than in any other land. As to how it is got, here again I am not able to say for certain, but it is said to be carried off from the Griffins by Arimaspians, a one-eyed race of men. But I do not believe this tale either, that nature produces one-eyed men which in all other respects are like other men. I wonder if this guy's subtleties are getting across. If I'm getting across this guy's subtleties. But anyways, I mean, you know, like the moral of the story, it's like really short. But he says, I don't believe this tale either, that nature produces one-eyed men, which in all other respects are like other men, that being that this one-eyed race of men carried off all the gold from the Griffins. That's what he's saying. I mean, it sounds like he's not really saying anything, but there actually are things being said here. I don't know why I said that. This one is called the Ouroboros. Today, the ocean is a sea or system of seas. For the Greeks, Oceanus was a circular river that girdled the earth. All waters flowed from it, and it had neither outlet nor source. It was also a god, or a titan, perhaps the oldest of all, for sleep, in Book 14 of the Iliad, calls Oceanus he from whom all the gods arose. In Hesiod's Theogony, Oceanus is the father of the swirling rivers, which number 3,000, and foremost of which are Nilos, the Nile, and Alpheus. Oceanus was customarily portrayed as an old man with a full flowing beard. After many centuries, humanity discovered a better symbol. Heraclitus had said that in the circle, the beginning and end are a single point. A 3rd century Greek amulet to be found today in the British Museum gives us an image that can better illustrate that infinitude, the serpent that bites its own tail, or, as a Spanish poet put it, that begins at the tip of its tail. Ouroboros, he who devours his tail, is this monster's technical name, later employed in myriad texts by the alchemists. This creature's most famous appearance is in Norse cosmogony. In the Younger or Prose Edda, Loki is said to have engendered a wolf and a serpent. An oracle warned the gods that these creatures would be the earth's doom. The wolf, Fenrir, was bound by a fetter called Gleipnir, made from 6 things. The noise a cat makes when it moves, the beard of woman, the roots of a mountain, the sinews of a bear, the breath of a fish, and the spittle of a bird. The serpent, Jormungandr, the Midgard serpent, was flung into the deep sea which surrounds the whole world, and it grew so large that it now lies in the middle of the ocean, round the earth, biting its own tail. In Jotunheim, or Giant Land, Utgarda Loki once challenged the god Thor to lift a cat. Thor, using all his strength, could barely lift one of the cat's paws off the ground. This cat was Jormungandr, and Thor was tricked by magic. When the twilight of the gods shall come, the serpent shall devour the earth, and the wolf shall devour the sun. I mean, you heard it here first. Maybe you didn't hear it here first. Maybe you heard it somewhere else. I'm operating on a mobile hotspot here because for some reason the cable hookup is not hooking up. Okay, this one is called The Panther. In medieval bestiaries, the word panther refers to an animal quite different from the carnivorous mammal of contemporary zoology. Aristotle had said that the odor of this beast attracts other animals. Aelian, the Latin author known as the honey-tongued for his mastery of Greek, declared that this odor was grateful to man as well. These statements have led to the conjecture that there was some confusion between the panther and the civet. According to Pliny, there are reports that the, quote, panther has on the shoulder a spot which bears the form of the moon, and that, like it, it regularly increases to full and then diminishes to a crescent. To these marvelous circumstances, there came to be added the fact that in the Septuagint, the word panther is used once in a way that might refer to Christ. I actually have that bestiary right here, translated by T.H. White. And this description of how the panther was related to Christ is pretty lengthy. Anyways, in the Anglo-Saxon bestiary known as the Exeter Book, the panther is a solitary, kind animal with a melodious voice and a fragrant breath. It makes its home in the mountains in a secret place. Its only enemy is the dragon with which it is constantly embattled. A 12th century Latin bestiary adds details to this description. It sleeps for three nights, and when it awakens, singing, multitudes of men and animals are drawn by the music and the fragrance of its breath, and they make their way from the fields, castles, and cities to its cave. The dragon is the old enemy. The devil. The awakening is the resurrection of the Lord. The multitudes are the community of the faithful. The panther is Jesus Christ. To mitigate the astonishment this allegory may produce, let us recall that the panther was not a fierce and fearsome beast. For the Saxons, but rather an exotic sound, backed by a none too concrete image. It might be added to compound the curiosity that Eliot's poem Gerontion speaks of Christ the tiger. Leonardo da Vinci included the panther in Africa among the beasts in his bestiary. Here is his description. This has the shape of a lioness, but it is taller in the leg and slimmer and longer and quite white, marked with black spots after the manner of rosettes. All the animals are fascinated by these as they gaze out at them, and they would remain standing there always if it were not for the terror of its face. Being conscious of this, therefore, it hides its face, and the animals that are round about it take courage and draw near, so as to be able the better to enjoy so much beauty. It then suddenly seizes on the nearest and instantly devours it. So in that case, curiosity doesn't kill the cat, I guess. The cat kills the curious. Well, everybody wants to know about the Phoenix, and so here it is. In monumental statuary and pyramids of stone and as mummies, the Egyptians sought eternal life. It seems only natural, then, that it should be Egypt where the myth of an immortal periodic bird was born, though the later elaboration of the myth is the work of the Greeks and Romans. Hermann writes that in the mythology of Heliopolis, the phoenix, or Bennu, is the lord of jubilees, long cycles of time, and a famous passage Herodotus tells with repeated incredulity, an early form of the legend. Another bird also is sacred. It is called the phoenix. I myself have never seen it, but only pictures of it, for the bird comes but seldom into Egypt, once in 500 years, as the people of Heliopolis say. It is said that the phoenix comes when his father dies. If the picture truly shows his size and appearance, his plumage is partly golden but mostly red. He is most like an eagle in shape and bigness. The Egyptians tell a tale of this bird's devices which I do not believe. He comes, they say, from Arubia, bringing his father the sun's temple enclosed in myrrh, and there buries him. His manner of bringing is this. First, he molds an egg of myrrh as heavy as he can carry, and when he has proved its weight by lifting it, he then hollows out the egg and puts his father in it, covering over with more myrrh the hollow in which the body lies. So the egg, being with his father in it, is of the same weight as before. The phoenix, after enclosing him, carries him to the temple of the sun in Egypt, and such is the tale of what is done by this bird. Some 500 years later, Tacitus and Pliny took up this marvelous story once again. Tacitus quite properly observed that antiquity is obscure, but that tradition had established the phoenix's lifespan at 1,461 years. Pliny, too, researched the chronology of the phoenix. He tells us that according to Manilius, it lives for the space of one Platonic year, the great year of or Annum Magnum. This is the time required by the sun, the moon, and the five planets to return to their original positions. Tacitus, in his Dialogues, claims that this great revolution takes 12,994 ordinary years to complete. The ancients believed that when this astronomical cycle was accomplished, universal history would be repeated down to the last detail, since the influence of the planets would also be repeated. The phoenix would, in that case, be a mirror or image of the universe. An even more precise analogy may be found in the philosophy of the Stoics, who taught us that the universe dies in fire and is reborn from fire, and that just as the process had no beginning, so shall it have no end. Time has simplified the mechanism by which the phoenix is born. Herodotus mentions an egg, Pliny a little worm or maggot, but by the end of the 6th century, a poem by Claudianus celebrates an immortal bird that rises again from its ashes, its own heir, and a witness to the ages. Few myths have been so widespread as that of the phoenix. To the names of those authors already mentioned, we might add Ovid and Metamorphoses, Dante in the Inferno, Shakespeare and Henry VIII, Pellicer in the Phoenix and its Natural History, Quevedo and Parnaso Español, Milton and Samson Agonists. We might also mention the Latin poem De Ave Phoenici, attributed to Lactantius, and a 7th century Anglo-Saxon imitation of that poem. Tertullian, St. Ambrose, and Cyrilius of Jerusalem have cited the phoenix as proof of the resurrection of the flesh. Pliny mocks those physicians who prescribe remedies extracted from the nest and ashes. This passage is called Pygmies. The ancients believed that this race of dwarf-like individuals, 27 inches tall, Pliny tells us, lived within the borders of Hindustan or Ethiopia. Certain authors claim that they built their dwellings out of eggshells. Others, such as Aristotle, have written that they lived under the ground in caves. To harvest their wheat, they were said to arm themselves with axes as though they were going forth to cut down a forest. They rode lambs and goats of a size befitting them. Each year they would be invaded by flocks of cranes that came from the steppes of Russia. Pygmy was also the name of a deity whose face the Carthaginians carved on the prows of their warships in order to terrify their enemies. Okay, in keeping with the nymphs, here are the sylphs. For each of the four roots or elements into which the Greeks divided matter, there was a corresponding spirit. In the work of Paracelsus, the 16th century Swiss alchemist and physician, we find four elementary spirits: the gnomes of earth, the nymphs of water, the salamanders of fire, and the sylphs or sylphides of air. These words are of Greek origin. Littré has sought the etymology of sylph in the Celtic tongues, but it is most unlikely that Paracelsus would have known or even suspected the existence of those languages. Today, no one believes in sylphs, but the phrase, a sylph-like figure, is still applied to slender women as a somewhat cliched compliment. The sylphs occupy a place between that of material beings and that of immaterial beings. Romantic poetry and the ballet find them useful. Here we have Talos. Living creatures made of stone or metal constitute an alarming species within fantastic zoology. We might recall the fire-breathing bronze bulls that Jason, with the aid of Medea's magic, yoked to the plow. Condillac's statue of sentient marble endowed with a human psyche and, in the Thousand Nights and a Night, the man of gleaming metal, wearing a leaden plate upon his breast, inscribed with mystic signs and talismans, who rescued and then abandoned the third Kalandar when the Kalandar toppled the brass horsemen that stood atop the lodestone mountain. Other such creatures are the girls of mild silver or of furious gold that a goddess in the mythology of William Blake snared in nets of silk for a man. The metallic birds that were the nursemaids of Ares. And Talos, who guarded the Isle of Crete. Some declare Talos to be the work of Vulcan or of Daedalus. Apollonius of Rhodes in the Argonautica says that he was the last survivor of the race of grass. Three times each day, Talos circled Crete, hurling boulders at those who attempted to disembark. Heated red hot, he embraced men and killed them. His only vulnerable spot was his heel. Instructed by the sorceress Medea, Castor and Pollux, the Dioscuri slew him. Moving east, the Tao Te. The existence of this creature is unknown to poets and mythology alike, but all of us at one time or another have come upon it in the corner of a capital or the center of a frieze, and have felt a slight shudder of revulsion. Orthrus, the dog that guarded the cattle of the three-bodied Geryon, and that Hercules quickly dispatched, had two heads and one body. The Tao Te inverts this image and is even more horrible, for its huge head is attached to one body on the right and another on the left. It generally has six legs, since its four legs serve both bodies. Its head may be that of a dragon, a tiger, or a person. Historians of art call it the ogre mask. It is a monster of form, inspired by the devil of symmetry in the imagination of sculptors, potters, and ceramicists. 1400 years before the Christian era, during the Shang dynasty, it already figured on ritual bronzes. Tao Te means glutton. The Chinese paint it on porcelains in order to warn against self-indulgence. All right, here's for all my friends with an affinity for the Waldorfians. The Waldorfians. This one is called Thermal Beings. The visionary theosophist Rudolf Steiner experienced a revelation through which he learned that this planet, before it became the Earth that we know, passed through three stages or incarnations. The first was that of Saturn. This is in the text, but I would assume that Sun Ra would attest to the truth of that. Okay. The first was that of Saturn. Then that of the sun, then that of the moon. The human being is, at the present time, composed of four members: the physical body, the life body or ethereal body, the astral body, and the ego. At the beginning of the Saturn stage of evolution, it was a physical body alone. But this body was neither visible nor tangible, since at that time there was neither solids nor liquids nor gases on the earth. There was a state only of heat. Thermal forms. Various colors defined the regular and irregular forms that inhabited cosmic space. Each man, or each being, was an organism whose matter was changing temperatures. According to Steiner, the human beings of the Saturn era were a deaf and dumb and impalpable complex of articulated colds and heats. His Geheimwissenschaft im Umriss, or Outline of the Occult Sciences, forgive my German, tells us that for the researcher, heat is only a substance still finer than gas. Before the sun stage of evolution, archangels or spirits of fire animated the bodies of these quote-unquote human beings who began to shine and glow. Did Rudolf Steiner dream these things? Did he dream them because they had actually occurred far back in the depths of time? One thing we do know, they are much more awe-inspiring than the demiurges and serpents and bulls of other cosmogonies. So, praise for Steiner from Borges. Anyways, we're winding our way towards the next hour and the end of my show. This is called The Unicorn. The first and last versions of the unicorn are virtually identical. 4 centuries before the Christian era, the Greek author Croesus, physician to Artaxerxes Mnemon, reported that in the kingdoms of Hindustan there were extremely swift wild asses with white skin, a purple head, blue eyes, and a sharp horn on the forehead. The base of this horn, Croesus tells us, was white. Its tip was red, and in the middle it was thoroughly black. Pliny gives more detail. The Orcian Indians hunt down a very fierce animal called the Monoceros, which has the head of the stag, the feet of the elephant, and the tail of the boar, while the rest of the body is like that of the horse. It makes a deep lowing noise, and has a single black horn which projects from the middle of its forehead 2 cubits in length. This animal, it is said, cannot be taken alive. In 1892, the Orientalist Schrader posited that the unicorn might have been suggested to the Greeks by certain Persian bas-reliefs portraying bulls in profile, so that only one horn was shown. In the etymologies of Isidore of Seville, composed in the early 7th century, we read that a blow from the horn of the unicorn can kill an elephant. This recalls the analogous victory of the Carcadon or rhinoceros in the second voyage of Sinbad. Sinbad tells us that the rhinoceros horn, when cleft in twain, is the likeness of a man. Al-Kazwini says it is the figure of a man on horseback, and others mention birds and fishes. Another of the unicorn's adversaries was the lion, and one of the 9 lion Spenserians in the second book of that tangled allegory, The Fairy Queen, has preserved the way a battle between those 2 noble creatures might be fought. The lion would stand in front of a tree, the unicorn head lowered, charges, the lion steps aside, and the unicorn's horn sticks in the tree trunk. This description dates from the 16th century. At the beginning of the 18th, the union between England and Scotland would pit the English leopard or lion against the Scottish unicorn on the kingdom's coats of arms. In the Middle Ages, bestiaries taught that the unicorn might be captured by a virgin. In the Physiologus Graecus, we read the following. He can be trapped by the following stratagem. A virgin girl is led to where he lurks, and there she is sent off by herself into the wood. He soon leaps into her lap when he sees her and embraces her, and hence he gets caught. A medallion by Pisanello and many famous tapestries illustrate this victory, whose allegorical applications are familiar to all. The Holy Spirit, Christ, Mercury, and evil have been symbolized at one time or another by the unicorn. Jung's treatise, Psychology and Alchemy, records and analyzes these symbols. A little white horse with the 4 legs of an antelope, the beard of a goat, and a long twisted horn on its forehead is today the most common image of this fantastic animal. Leonardo da Vinci attributes the unicorn's capture to the beast's lack of temperance. and the delight that it has for young girls. That aspect of its nature makes it forget its ferocity and wildness and lie in the lap of the maiden, and thus